Hello, and welcome to Hyped, the podcast for the culturally curious that turns a critical eye on some of the most hyped books, plays, films, TV, music, and events of recent years, but especially the present. Join us as we work out where these cultural trends have come from and what they reveal about modern society. I'm Zoe Strimple, a columnist and a historian of gender in modern Britain, and I also have a baby now on my chest who might make the odd noise. So that's just a warning in case you hear gurgles and even the odd shout.
I think we should introduce Nicole Strumpel on the call. It's a great honor she's joining us today.
Yeah, it may cease to be an honor pretty quickly. Meet Nicole Daniela Elizabeth Strimple Court. She's started to wake up now, in which case, yes.
She's a budding historian of
She's a
gender.
budding historian. Yeah, she's got a lot of opinions, but she just doesn't know how to express them.
And I'm Tom Stammers. I'm a historian of France and a general cultural glutton with a weakness for all things 19th century. Zoe and I have been consuming and debating culture together ever since we were at university, which is now so long ago that the science fiction that was current was being written by H.G. Wells.
Yeah, you were the guy who survives in War of the Worlds.
You were Dr. Moreau. You were the Invisible Man.
exactly. Unusually for us, we're going to take a dive into sci-fi, and easily the most impressive sci-fi film of the age is Dune, which is based, or Dune 2 is what we're going to be talking about today, which is based on a books from the 1970s, which could have been written today. They feel incredibly current. They're amazing films. But Tom, do you want to give us some background on Dune and specifically Dune 2?
I enjoy how you're savoring the word Dune. So Dune 2 has just come out. It is already the biggest grossing film of 2024. Dune 1 was a huge success, but Dune 2 has taken $200 million more in the time that it's been out and is still going. I mean, the other interesting thing about this is, well, hopefully lots of people listening to this have already seen Dune 2. It's been such a success that they've just announced that the IMAX cinemas are going to keep showing it for a whole other, and I was lucky enough to see it on IMAX with Zoe, and it is made for the big screen, but it's become a whole way of consuming it is to go back and see it again and again on these big kind of IMAX screens. It's had
And this is
fantastic
your
reviews.
second viewing as well, Tom. You're in that camp of again and again. How did it hold up on viewing number two?
I thought much improved, probably because I slept a little bit through my first viewing, which is not a reflection on the film. It's a reflection on my kind of disrupted sleeping habits. But I thought actually it really benefited from a second viewing because there were things that I'd missed first time round that once you see the whole arc of it, you sort of, it's that much more understandable to go back to it second time round. The other thing to say about Dune, so these are films made by Denis Villeneuve, who I think is an incredible director, kind of visionary director. Who did the film Arrival? If anybody's seen this, that I was also a massive fan of with Amy Adams and the Aliens. This is another kind of, this is a sci-fi allegory of a different kind. He also did the new Blade Runner film a few years ago, the updated Blade Runner. So he's really interested in sci-fi. The books themselves are a series of book novels written by somebody called Frank Herbert. And the first of the Dune novels was written in 1965, although he then kept adding to them deep into the 1970s. And actually, this film, Dune 2, is the second part of a trilogy that we know that Dune 3, Dune Messiah, will be coming in the next couple of years as well. So this is, in the wake of Barbie, this is probably the single most important franchise, which has kind of revitalized the cinema in the past couple of years.
That's interesting that you're comparing a doll franchise to a kind of sci-fi fiction franchise, but and well, don't forget Wonder Woman and things like that.
True. I suppose just in terms of getting people to go back to the cinema and believing that they want to see something on the big screen, Barbie, Oppenheimer, Dune, they've kind of together probably, they probably account for the majority of receipts in a lot of cinemas over the past 12 months.
I think so, and but I'll say that I enjoyed Oppenheimer. Sorry, I enjoyed Dune 2 about 1,000 times more than I enjoyed either Barbie or Oppenheimer, and I think that's quite interesting. I guess what did it for me about Dune 2, and I want to know what did it for you, Tom, is just the sheer. It's like being a baby in a or a child in a candy shop. I mean, just the it fires on every piston, every sense is like mesmerized. It's like all new. The sounds, the visual, the kind of the rhythms of it are actually the least important part is the dialogue and the kind of the words actually. And I find that so often now, scripts are lame, overdone, or you can't actually understand what the characters are saying, which is handy because Tom keeps booking us tickets to audio impaired showing where there are subtitles, which are actually really horrible and disruptive.
This
But
comes back to Tom falling asleep too often in the cinema. I need subtitles
yeah,
now.
otherwise he just keels over. But this was, I mean, that from the, there's some sort of signature traits of Dune, which has created this kind of incredible aesthetic, as well as an aural landscape. But you know, the thing that they have these, they create these sandworms, which I actually don't really understand the significance of them. But it involves putting down this kind of pump that creates an avalanche, basically, in the desert. And it's incredible. It's very evocative, very sinister. It's a bit like a heartbeat. It's a bit like something in the womb.
Yes.
And everything feels kind of cosmic, I suppose.
Yes.
And also deeply biological, and it's the way that the cosmic and the biological, the huge and the tiny, the microscopic, the pulsing of life, and then the kind of pulsing that is echo that echoes it of the universe. He kind of keeps those things going throughout the whole thing, in all the visual tropes, in all the sound tropes, and you know, in the in just in the amazing costumes and the look of the cities and the look of the weapons. It's
Yep.
just so different and satisfying. And you know, compared to something like a Mad Max, which I think I tried to watch at one point, or the, you know, horrible, like totally unappealing, this is just beautiful and eerie and interesting at all times. What grabbed you about it, Tom? And why do you, and do you want to actually just give, because I'm too thick these days to understand the plots of these things. Do you want to just quickly sketch how two leads on from one?
Oh dear. Yeah, I'll have a go, Zoe. I think what you say about the cinematography is completely right. And there is something about the scale and like the way that the story is interwoven with these enormous landscapes and environments that go from the very intimate to the completely sublime that is really inspired. And I think you're entirely right. There's something about the attention to detail in the smallest facet of this, and also this ability to sort of pan out and have these huge, mesmerizing, kind of immersive sand landscapes. I mean, all of that is brilliant. In terms of building a world, actually, some people have compared it to Black Panther in terms of a film where there's a similar sense, which, I don't think is probably as intellectually ambitious, but probably was another film where it created a whole new aesthetic and it created a fascination for a whole universe that looked different and that was a similar sense of the familiar, but also the deeply unfamiliar, a kind of like space age version of Africa. Well, this is a kind of space age Saudi Arabia in a way that is also kind of interesting to think about. In terms of how this and that sort of relates to the politics of it, and I suppose we could talk about that at some point as well. Briefly, in terms of plot, how this builds on the first one. In the first film, that was all about the fall of the Atreides. So this is Timothée Chalamet's family. And those of us who know classical tragedy will be like, ah, the Atreides, like the house of Atreus in classical Greece, in the house that's at the heart of the Oresteia. The doomed house of Atreus. So we see at the end of the first film the murder of Paul's father. Paul is the character played by Timothée Chalamet, and the takeover of his city Arrakis on the desert on the desert kind of planet of Dune. He's sort of betrayed by the Emperor and these sort of evil, blobby, kind of terrifying hairless characters called the Harkonnens. That's the sort of end of the first film. And in this, it's about his son, Paul, played by Timothée Chalamet, and his widow, played by the amazing Rebecca Ferguson, who I think is totally fantastic, who, as a mother and son double act, have now have to sort of survive by trusting to the indigenous inhabitants of the planet, the Fremen, who are very much Bedouin. And there's lots of interesting parallels one might think about, and they can survive because they live in the desert. And their whole ethos is to try and frustrate the attempts of the people from outside to come and extract spice from the planet. And spice, of course, is a metaphor for oil. There's a sort of interesting environmentalist ethos hanging over the book about these kind of brutal extraction policies that are coming to the desert and ripping out these resources, and the attempts of the kind of indigenous Fremen to try and kind of thwart that endeavor. The one other thing to put in the mix is The novel and the film is shot through with a kind of mystical religiosity, where Paul realizes that if he wants to fight back against the Harkonnens and get revenge for what happened to his father, he may or may not embrace some of the wild prophecies that are told about him, but and that are believed by the desert people, the Fremen. So there's a whole white messiah sub-theme, which is also running through it. And the question of whether he should or shouldn't embrace these kind of extreme religious forces is one of the other kind of major threads running through it. What did you think of the performances, Zoe, before we talk about the politics?
Yeah, well, the performances, well, what's so great about this film is that it doesn't require too much weight on the perform. Like, the performances are very good and they're very powerful, but it's more like, again, it's how they fit into the visual compass. And so, you know, yes, the actors are very good at like delivering their few lines. But what I love about it is that they're all fairly understated.
Yeah.
We don't tend to see that many kind of cheesy displays. You know, there's a sort of register that is also a bit different and a bit alien and a bit part of this other universe. And the Fremens are, you know, Javier Bardem, obviously, like, you know,
Javier Bardem loves being a Fremen. He's like never been happier in a role.
Exactly. And, you know, there is some religious ecstasy and stuff like that. And he embraces that side of things. But he's, you know, he's kind of a master actor. So it it doesn't grate. Chalamet is so good because he doesn't, you know, he's got this role that could be massively overplayed. And he realizes that the power of it is like kind of in this understatement, which is also why he gains all these followers, because he just kind of gets on with it in a nutshell. And then the female characters are all amazing. Then this, but you know, again, the performances are overshadowed by the incredible visual stuff. The Harkonnen, their weird look, their kind of weird.
They're fascistic. I mean, the brilliant middle
the
sequence
urban,
of the film,
yeah,
which is all in the monochrome, and it's like something out of Nuremberg. It's like a Leni, yeah, Riefenstahl meets
That's
Gladiator,
right,
kind of middle section.
Right. It's kind of North Korea meets Leni Riefenstahl meets Saudi Arabia meets Gladiator. It's completely delicious and weird, and you know, monochrome, and you know, the guy who the Harkonnen, the chief Harkonnen, the fat guy who comes out of the black ooze.
Oh, Skellen Skarsgård. Amazing. Skellen
Oh, is
Skarsgård.
that
Kind
him?
of like a balloon man, kind of,
yeah,
coming and sinking into these pool, these black pools that he,
yeah,
lives in.
It's every single inch of it is creative. You know, the fact that the Fremen have these blue eyes that once Timothée Chalamet's character and his mother drink this sort of
the worm urine.
Yeah, it's absolutely
when they eat the
foul.
Spice, or they drink the worm urine,
yeah,
then they get the blue
they
eyes.
They go through this kind of fit and nearly die, and then they get this kind of Fremen blue eyes. And it's just every single aspect. It's, Tom, you articulated well this, the strange subtlety of the religious themes that go through it, because it is a bit ambiguous. You know, some people in the Fremen, including the women and his love interest, are very skeptical of falling into this like prophet motif, and it's by the end it's a bit unclear. I mean, he does seem to seize it, and it does seem like the narrative and mythological weight of these prophecies and these kind of religions is too much even for the character that Timothée Chalamet plays, Paul. And it seems like he's succumbing to it and is going epic with it. In which, you know, actually, Tom, as that as a pivot, what do you, how does that then, what you mentioned when we left that it's sort of endless jihad is the note we leave it on. What are the politics of this then? I mean, I did think, oh God, we're hearing about kind of the small man of the desert being,
you've got it, resistance of the indigenous people,
right,
against
being
the kind of
walloped by
sinister
the big,
colonial forces
exactly,
coming to extract
yeah,
resources completely.
And is that what was intended by the author?
So Herbert, as I say, was writing in the 60s, and I think it's important for that to say he was really interested in what was happening in the Middle East. You know, this is the in the wake of Suez and the kind of the redevelopment of kind of Arab nationalism in the 50s and 60s. He was definitely interested in that question and the kind of the oil economy. And we also know he was super interested in Lawrence of Arabia, as a kind, and it's interesting the parallels, both cinematographically, I guess, between Dune and Lawrence of Arabia as another huge technicolor feast, you know, with all these amazing locations and these kind of desert panoramas, but also in the kind of political content of the kind of the white outsider who is able to give the Arabs their freedom. But the whole question is then, does he betray the people that he's ultimately come to serve? Like, is he really on their side, or is he kind of between worlds, between the kind of white Europeans and the Arabs that he's ultimately come to inspire? So there is a lot of interesting politics in it. There's also quite an interesting debate going on in social media about how far the film has kind of erased the Islamic content. Certainly various people have been quite stroppy about it and said that it's a film that's in praise of white supremacy, because it has all of these borrowings from Islam, but it doesn't actually use many Muslim actors. I mean, Zendaya obviously is a non-white actor, but there aren't otherwise, you know, people would have liked more Arab casting. And also, I think some people feel in general that it's a kind of whitewashed version of Middle Eastern politics that doesn't really think about the implications of being on the side, as you say, of indigenous rebels against colonizing outsiders, especially at the current moment. I'm sure, you know, that it could have played out in a much more divisive and kind of inflammatory way. And I think Villeneuve doesn't want to get bogged down into anything too literal about the politics, even though that's the kind of framework in which the novel was kind of conceived. Just to say one thing about the Messiah thing, at the end of this novel, sorry, and at the end of this part of the film, what we see is that, and this, here's the spoiler, as Paul manages to get revenge against the Harkonnen and avenge the death of his father, he realizes the only way he can do that is by allying himself with the fanatics, with all the people who do think that he is this kind of messiah figure who's come and will lead them all to freedom. And in the final sequence, what we see is, yes, they manage to kind of reclaim the planet from the colonizers, but they also then export what is described as a kind of endless jihad into the entire universe. So what you see at the end is actually jihad, this spiritual war, going from being a national struggle to now becoming a kind of interplanetary galactic struggle. And it's, you know, and that's the interesting thing about Dune, is that Paul, as a result, is an anti-hero in a way. I mean, or he realizes the only way that he can win is by releasing these forces that he himself knows he can't control, that he has to kind of give in to the kind of weight of history that's pushing him towards, you know, opening a new era of extremism and fundamentalism, which means it isn't a straightforward hero narrative at all. And we're seeing something darker come through in him, I think, as the film goes on. You see, as you said, Zoe, him succumbing more and more to the belief in his own kind of potency, or his ability to twist that for his own purposes.
Well, I don't know. I think it's just that he's being pragmatic, and that, you know, gets at the mysterious heart of many kind of political, you know, Napoleon or other, I don't know, dictators or whatever. You know, how much of it is just, okay, in order to win, I need to marshal the firepower of these religious maniacs. And how much is, you know, even though that carries the risk of being so volatile if it goes wrong, and how much of it is an actual messiah complex burgeoning in him? You know, is he, because the whole time he's this kind of marvel of modesty. And it seems to be that's, you know, he's happy to renounce everything and just sort of fit in, and he'll give his life for these people. I mean, he really is the model of fitting in, I guess.
Well, the leader who comes to serve. Again, it's a kind of Christian model in a way. Yes. Like the king shall actually abase himself. Yeah. That's the twist.
Yeah. That's exactly it. And but so by the end, and, you know, I think the real moment that we start to think, uh-oh, trouble brews, isn't so much in the intergalactic, it's in his romantic life.
Well, exactly, Zoe.
He had, you know, we see the increasing sense that by Zendaya's character, who's his love interest, this Fremen fighter, that he's going in the wrong direction, maybe drinking his own Kool-Aid. And then at the end, he says he'll marry Florence Pugh,
the emperor's daughter.
They're all here, yeah. And you know,
as you say, it's like, who is not in this film? Oh, another cameo by a leading star. Yeah. But you're right to say the romantic betrayal is one of the ways that it communicates to the audience that Paul is going on a path that leads towards his own power, maybe at the expense of the heart, or at the expense of some of the principles that had animated him before.
Exactly. He kind of becomes vainglorious, maybe, or something like that.
And definitely the next novel is quite sinister. Dune Messiah is a full-on study of a kind of a tyrant drunk on his own kind of mythic power.
Oh God, so Paul does become a tyrant.
This was the transitional film. Paul becomes quite sinister in part
Oh,
three.
no.
I mean, it really is about the extremes of religious fanaticism as both something that could be democratic in the sort of liberatory moment, but also could be quite authoritarian in the way that it's used as a tool of control. But yeah, did you think that the women, you know, that having the kind of romantic and the big sort of political struggle running together, did you feel that that worked, or did the sentimental stuff kind of get in the way of the film somehow, or slow it down?
I think it was a bit funny because it's like, oh, right. They have like Hollywood La La Land rom-com cameos in whatever their planet is called, like, you know, in the Dune people, while protecting spice and fighting Harkonnen. There's still time for a romantic snog on a desert mound. So that I found funny. But yeah, I don't really understand why, if this universe everything's different, why there's a kind of like, what is the scope of their relationship? Are other people having relationships? It just seems.
It's not clear what the romantic economy among the Fremen
That's
is.
right. I
That's
was
true.
confused by what the romantic economy was on in the galaxy.
But it's interesting that it's quite the Fremen are quite a matriarchal society in
They
other
are, but
ways, like
so is any.
Reverend Mother.
That's true. Oh my God, talk about the roll call. Léa Seydoux and
Oh,
Charlotte
delicious.
Rampling. I mean, they're also very interesting, these kind of priestesses.
Now, Zoe, here's your start of a 10. What are the priestesses called?
Oh, the Bene Gesserit.
Oh, beautiful, Zoe.
Yeah.
Bene Gesserit. Absolutely.
The
Yeah.
Bene Gesserit. Yeah, exactly. Like the Secretariat. Very interesting. I mean, where again, they have this kind of womanly, non-physical control, but then at the end of the day, they kind of call all the shots.
Well, and that's where I think it wasn't really. People who try and say that Frank Herbert just appropriated all this stuff from Islam, and then, you know, and that this has all been concealed subsequently, is, you know, is complete nonsense. In that, yes, there are Islamic touches. You know, some of the muadib or whatever. There are Arabic words in there, but there's also loads of stuff borrowed from, as I say, the Greeks. If you think about the Atreus, there's bits of Shakespeare in there. I felt the final duel between Paul and the kind of demonic cousin, Hyde Rotha, Baron Hyde Rotha, who's played by Austin Butler, who as a complete psychopath, you know, the hairless mad sort of psychopath, was like the end of Hamlet. It's like Hamlet and Laertes in a weird way. You know, and the revenge plot that goes wrong, you know, in a way, there's a sort of Shakespeare in there. But then there's also all this Catholic stuff. And I do think the Bene Gesserit, as you say, are like sort of Inquisitor nuns. There's not really a kind of Islamic correlate to this idea about these sort of secret advisors to power who control the destiny of things but are an order of women. It's a super interesting blend of different
It
mythologies.
is. And I think there's probably Hinduism in there, and there's probably Kabbalah and Jewish ancient rabbinical.
Yeah, well, waiting for the Messiah completely. And Herbert himself converted to Buddhism, Zoe. There's a thing
Oh,
for you. He was a
really? How
Catholic who
interesting.
became a Buddhist. So he is, as you say, it's a whole spiritual salad that he'd kind of put together in those novels.
Just before we finish, Tom, can you just, I mean, I should know this, but don't. Were the Dune books popular in the 60s?
Hugely popular in the 60s. And actually, what's interesting is that one of the reasons why people are so thrilled by the Dune films at the moment is that they're the first time that they've been successfully filmed. In that somebody called Jodorowsky, who was a kind of avant-garde experimental filmmaker, tried to make a version in the 70s, didn't happen. David Lynch made a version in the 80s that now looks kind of camp and silly, but like he had a go at doing it in the 80s. And now we've had this. So this is the third time that Dune's
You
been
know, it's interesting. I
attempted to be
think
filmed.
that must be because this is finally a good thing for technology. It's, you know, we complain a lot about the march of technology, but in terms of it hollowing out various art forms, but it's almost like the real rendering of Dune had to wait until we were at this point of CGI and special effects and stunts and things like that.
Completely, and also good diplomatic relations with Jordan, so that you can film lots of it in Wadi Rum.
Oh, is that
And
what
you know,
they did?
loads of it's filmed in Wadi Rum, and some bits also in Dubai, I think. But lots of it is on location in the Middle East, which is
Oh
also kind of
wow,
interesting.
that is good, but not in Saudi Arabia.
Well, I wonder. Maybe there are bits of it filmed in Saudi. But I think you're entirely right, Zoe. I think, like, unlike Star Wars, which I think, you know, all hail George Lucas, he was able to do it. Obviously, that wasn't a novel, but he was able to make it work visually in the 70s or 80s. Dune has not looked Dune has looked silly in its previous iterations, and we have had to kind of wait for the for it to catch up. It's interesting comparing Herbert with Lucas as well, because you know Star Wars is also a novel that tries to bring together, not a novel, it's a film that tries to bring together lots of different mythologies. They both read the same book by this guy called Joseph Campbell, called The Hero with a Thousand Faces, which basically argued that all world mythologies are variations on a common plot. And so whether it's Hinduism, whether it's kind of you know, and the Vedas, whether it's to do with Greek mythology, that there's basically archetypes. And both of them are kind of very archetypal, allegorical films. But Star Wars, I think, ultimately has got humor in it and is a kind of slightly sentimental story. Whereas what's interesting about Dune is there's actually very little humor and actually very little sentiment. It's a much darker piece.
I
Like
think
it's the heroism is much hollowed out.
that adds to it. It just really makes it more it makes it more powerful. He lets the things that are powerful speak and doesn't sort of crowd it with obvious messaging, and
Yes.
which is something that is such a bore and everything else, or things are too confusing, like in Oppenheimer. Anyway, we should leave it there, but next time.
Before Zoe tears into Christopher Nolan,
Yeah,
let's
it
leave
just reveals
it
that she finds every plot too complicated to
there.
understand. We're going to tackle, I know we've done a lot of Beyoncé, but it's got to be done, her latest album, Cowboy Carter, which Tom is already in love with, and I just didn't even realize had come out because I was probably too busy trying to figure out how to use a breast pump. But that's what we're going to look at next.